Nurse coaching is based on a holistic philosophy where we include the individual in their environment, the psychosocial determinants of health, their food, their sleep, their relationships, everything that influences health and well-being.
Hey guys, and welcome. You're listening to The Resilier Way with Jacob Gordon. I'm your host, Jacob, and I'm so excited to have you here today. In today's episode, we have Susan Luck, the Director of Nurse Coaching at Resilier Health. She is one of the pioneers of nurse coaching and is board certified in health and wellness coaching, holistic nursing, and clinical nutrition. I've read her work and she has a plethora of knowledge. So in today's episode, she's going to be sharing some of that knowledge with us. We will be discussing nurse coaching, environmental and household toxins, as well as some ways to identify bad products you may own and ways to detox your body. So without further ado, let's get started. All right, Susan, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to know a little bit more about you. I know you're part of the Resilier team, and I want to know your story. How did you get involved?
Oh, it's a long story.
Well, we have about an hour.
I've always been interested in a holistic approach to healthcare and how people stay healthy and what influences their health and well-being. And going back a couple of decades ago, I was a young nurse practicing community health in the highlands of Central America. And there were seasonal workers who would go to the farms and then come back to the mountain region where I was living and working in the community. And when people would come back, they had serious health issues. They had children with birth defects. They have cognitive issues. And when I explored it, just out of my own curiosity, and at the time I was a graduate student in medical anthropology, I was concerned about what I was witnessing. And it wound up that these seasonal workers had environmental exposures to pesticides. They were working in the crops in the lowlands, cotton, and other agriculture. And I started to make that connection between how the environment is affecting their health and well-being and that of future generations. And that really led me on a search. The other part is very personal. Both of my parents had cancer when they were considerably young, and I was always curious about what were the triggers, as we say in functional medicine. And so I started to explore what I knew about them, from smoking to hair dyes to eating processed foods. And I started again to research and study and make some correlations between the health, or I could say the epigenetics of my family tree and how it manifested in their lives and in their health. So I personally became very determined to avoid anything that might exacerbate any pre-existing genetic concerns or anything else. So I myself have been on a mission for 30 years of how to, quote, clean up my own internal and external environment. And that has been able to lead me to work with other people, patients, communities, to also explore what might be affecting their community or family health.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting. So you saw firsthand what pesticide use did to these people and also your parents with cancer.
Yes.
So you have a very personal experience with this.
I do.
And by the term epigenetics, so our listeners know what that means, what is it?
Well, epigenetics is that we all have genetic markers. We all have a code within our genes. And in, you know, the last decade or so, we've been able to really understand more and more about how the genes influence our health. But epigenetics is how those genes express themselves. So we could have a predisposition. Let's just say we have a predisposition for Alzheimer's or for breast cancer. There are genetic markers that we know about. But the question becomes, how do we protect those genes and protect ourselves from the potential health and concerns and what the triggers might be by not allowing those genes to change? The genes don't change, but the way they express themselves changes. And that's the field of epigenetics. And what's coined as a phrase is that our genes are not our destiny. we can no longer say because your parents had heart disease, you're destined, or because your mother had breast cancer, it's inevitable. How we modulate and manage our internal and external environment will directly affect whether or not we have this quote-unquote self-fulfilling prophecy, and how we can ward off or even totally stop that kind of expression.
Wow, that's fascinating about epigenetics. And so my next question for you, Susan, is how did you become a nurse coach? Also, what is a nurse coach? Because most people haven't heard of that term. They've heard of health coach or they've heard of nurses.
Okay, great question. So nurses are educators. We are advocates for our patients and our communities. And we help people navigate through their illness process, hopefully toward wellness. Again, there's a little story here that when I was working in the heart of the AIDS epidemic in the 80s in New York City and community health, people were kind of giving up. They were giving up on life. And I remember sitting and talking to groups because I did group, I'll call it now coaching. We didn't have that terminology back in the 80s. And I would say to people, if you could live, what would your life be like? What would it look like to you? What are some of your dreams that you would pursue if you did have a choice? Because people were so fatalistic in those early days, and rightly so. There were a few medications and there was a lot of exposure to segments in the community. And people would start to share their story. And for the first time, they began to think about, what if I lived? What would my life look like? And I remember one young man, George, who said, I would become a massage therapist. And fast forward 40 years, George is a massage therapist, even though in those days he didn't know he'd survive even a year. So I think my coaching came out of a lot of my own interest and how to work with people, not just telling them what to do, but inviting them to go deeper within to think about what has meaning and purpose in their lives. And another part of that in coaching is that we partner with the person rather than being the expert, which actually takes a lot of pressure off of us as practitioners to not have to have all the answers. I understand that, for example, here at Resilier, we do need to do the exploratory, the assessment, evaluation, and then come up with a protocol and a program. But what we know is that for people to really adhere to a program, they need to be on board. They can't just be told you need to take 40 supplements and follow these directions. They need to become engaged, and we need to have the individual think about what they want their life to look like moving forward. What if they could reverse some of their cognitive decline or all of their cognitive decline? And what are they willing to do? And then as a coach, we walk with them in that process. So how I got into nurse coaching is that there are 17 million nurses in the world. There are 4.5 million nurses in the United States alone. Nurses are in every community, in every healthcare setting, in business, in organizations. And so the question became, what if nurses could really assist people in this whole new model of personalized health and well-being, personalized medicine? And they're the perfect professional to be able to do this because they create close relationships with their patients, and trust is the first key ingredient for a successful coaching interaction. And as you probably know, nurses are every year after year, designated the most trusted profession in healthcare. And I think beyond healthcare, the most trusted profession. And we come out of a long legacy of health and well-being, because unless you're a nurse practitioner, you don't prescribe and you don't really tell people what to do. You support them. And so it just seemed like a really important movement within nursing. And parallel to that, there was a very big consumer movement for health coaches, and I'll put in quotes, lay coaches, who don't have the expertise in the background that nurses have. And so one of the things that we speak about is nurses have the ability to speak both the language of medicine and the language of healing. And when you combine both of those, you enter into a very special relationship with the people you're working with.
That's really great. It's like a more of a holistic approach to looking at everything.
Yes. And nurse coaching is based on a holistic philosophy where we include the individual and their environment, the psychosocial determinants of health, their food, their sleep, their relationships, everything that comes into what influences health and well-being. And can trigger things like inflammation, which we know is at the core of a lot of the work that we do here at Resilier. So it could be the environmental factors in our external world. It could be the foods we eat that affect our internal environment and how we process and have the nutrients to support a healthy immune system, healthy brain. And then it's all the other factors that are in our world. And it all changes day to day, minute to minute. You know, if air pollution or drinking unhealthy water, all of this at any given time can affect how our environment is influencing our health.
So from my understanding with nurse coaches, they have a particular pattern of how they decipher what's going on with the patient and how they work with the patient and they understand what's really going on. Can you describe to me a little bit about that process?
Yeah. So I created that diagram over a long time of reflecting on what is the ideal relationship between the nurse coach and the patient or client. And yes, at the core of that diagram is listening to the story. Listening is a key element in a positive coaching dynamic rather than the 7.5 minute office visit in standard medical practice, not here at Resilier for sure, but in standard medical practice, there is no time to listen to the story. Patient writes down their symptoms, they see the physician or the nurse practitioner, and then they're given a prescription or some advice like stop smoking. Well, we know how difficult it is to stop smoking, or we know how difficult it is to change one's diet, or change out their favorite personal care product, which we'll talk about in a while, meaning their favorite lotion or hairspray or toothpaste. And so how do we get to have people actually change behaviors, which is at the crux of coaching? And the way people change behaviors is to come to some deeper self-awareness. So around that, listening to the story by the coach, the nurse coach, we're also bringing new awareness to the person in their telling their story and us feeding back the story that they're telling us. So, for example, the person may say, I know I shouldn't smoke, but I love to smoke. And all my friends smoke. And when I'm in a social gathering, it seems really difficult. So I may say to the person, I hear that you want to stop smoking and it's very difficult. And find some ground in between where they can start to think about maybe it's changing their friends. Maybe it's, you know, only bringing one cigarette with them to work, but starting to make choices. So coaching is about new choices for behavioral change. And for a personalized approach to that. And not everyone is ready for the big picture. Sometimes it's just eliminating one can of soda or putting two less, you know, scoops of sugar in their morning coffee. It starts small. Wherever the person is at, that's where we meet them in coaching. And we hear their struggle and their challenges. And we try to move in coaching to a more positive way of thinking. You know, there's a whole positive psychology movement. And here at Resilier, we're steeped in that because all over the center, we see, you know, posters about hope and resilience. And these are the qualities that we try to foster and inspire and explore with people. And so in coaching in general, there's a whole system. It's an art and a science. It's not just coming out of nowhere. It's based on psychology and positive psychology. And within healthcare, it's based on what we now know in research about changing patterns of behavior can lead to improvement in outcomes, at relief of symptoms, relief of brain fog, etc.
So it sounds like you're able to change their mindset, give them a little bit of action, and once they catch on to that pattern, really grow from there.
So I would reframe that.
Okay.
I'm not changing them. Mm-hmm. They are changing themselves. And I am looking for opportunities and for cues to have people reflect on their belief systems and what they think is really important for them. That person who doesn't think they could improve in, let's just say, losing weight, when they start to think about what it would be like if they could, the older person, play ball with their grandchild, that might be their motivation to want to take that extra step. And their intention, an intention is really important. If your intention is to get better, that's a really important part of coaching. The person that doesn't think they're able to is less likely to have success. The person who says, I may be able to, or I will make this change, they're more likely to see improvement.
Well, it seems like a lot of people get stuck in that mindset there.
Yes.
And that's what I meant by mindset. You're helping them change their mindset so they don't feel stuck.
Yes. That is accurate. That is true.
So right now we've been going through a crisis of bad air quality where it seems like there's fires all over the U.S. We have an airborne pathogen. Mold is on the rise with all the hurricanes. So we're in this another kind of pandemic, but of air quality. What are some things that people can look at to improve their life at home so their air quality is okay?
Okay. So let's start. You mentioned mold.
Okay.
And that's something here at Resilier that we're very, very aware of and do a lot of testing in the home, have people, again, start to think about in a coaching model and in the assessment that we do with patients is to ask them, have they had any flooding in their home? Have they seen any mold growing on their, around their windows, up the walls? Has anything happened that precipitated or parallel when they started having symptoms? Because mold spores are airborne, eventually they fall onto the floor, onto the dust, and, you know, we kick them up and they recirculate. And if we don't deal with the mold, which sometimes is not as apparent, but we can do testing to look for it both in the home and in the body. In some of the testing we do, we could look at some of the, if you will, byproducts of when one has mold. Immunologically, we can see a lot of that. So mold is a really big one. We're speaking from South Florida today, and with the rains and hurricanes and storms, it's very common, as you said, for people to be concerned about mold. And mold is very insidious in the way that it affects us. Not everyone has these acute onset of symptoms. Sometimes it's generalized fatigue, a little brain fog, just not feeling well. And in the medical model...
And why is it that everyone feels it differently? Just because there can be someone in the household that feels nothing and the other person who's dying and called crazy because of it.
Right. And we see that a lot. Why? It's a combination of perhaps past history and the quality of one's immune system being able to fight mold. And some of it is genetics. There are people with genetic markers that can have more difficulty in what we'll call detoxifying mold, ridding the mold from their system. And then if people have other concurrent infections, like we see people with Lyme disease, with a history of other viral infections, we may have, it's compounded, and we may have people have more symptoms due to that. And the genetic factor is a big one. And we always are involved here at Resilier in looking at the genetics, the epigenetics that we mentioned, as well as the physical environment. But mold is something that when we're thinking about it, and we have, you know, a team that goes out to one's home to actually test for mold, but it's very important to think about, for those listening to this, have you had water damage from leaky pipes in the bottom of your kitchen sink or your bathroom sink? Have you had rains that have come in through the windows and the walls are now soft and peeling? Do you see stains on your ceiling if you're in a home that maybe is a leak from the roof? So these are just some very subtle areas. And then if people have a lot of clutter and they've had mold, then they might also have more dust. And mold has an affinity to fall onto the dust. And then it gets kicked up when the air conditioning goes on, when the cat runs through the house. And so they may have more mold spores that are circulating and they're breathing it in. And why some people don't have any symptoms, it may still be affecting their immune system, but they may have a more hardy immune system, so they're not experiencing at this time any of the effects.
You also mentioned how mold affects the brain. Could that be part of it? Like, some people may have inflammation in one part of their brain that doesn't affect their outward personality, where someone else may?
Definitely. I mean, mold definitely has a neuropathophysiological component. If people have had other infections, it's more so. But yes, the mold can definitely, very common is things like what we'll call brain fog. When we have people come into Resilier because they're having cognitive issues, one of the first things we think about is mold. Because if we're breathing in mold, it's circulating throughout the body and may have an affinity toward the brain, as does heavy metals and some other chemicals that are what we'll call neurotoxic. So a lot of times it's synergistic. It's a combination of different exposures. We may not be able to say it's mold that's causing your cognitive impairment, but it could be mold and using pesticides inside the home and eating foods or produce that have been sprayed with pesticides, that all combined can exacerbate those feelings.
So is it possible for someone, let's say they have been exposed, they live in a moldy building, but it wasn't until they got exposed to mercury or pesticides or something dangerous in their environment where they then became sensitive to mold?
Yes, absolutely. And we'll call,
or sensitive to other products or whatever it is?
Yes. We might say, again, that's the, we'll call it the toxic body burden that we refer to. It's kind of a chemical body burden and other stressors combined. So it's, you know, we're all exposed to chemicals. You mentioned air pollution. I think about all the people living in the West Coast, for example, that have been exposed to flame retardants when the planes go overhead to put out the fires. Those flame retardants are very toxic and have neurotoxic effects. So you might have a person who's had mold exposure, but when they now are getting exposed to the flame retardants and poor air quality that they're breathing in general, that those are triggers that will intensify and manifest in ways that suddenly the person is having issues. It could also affect them immunologically, where they're feeling other issues, you know, whether it's autoimmune or more frequent colds. Or I just read an article yesterday in a neurology journal on COVID, which is the times that we're in, and air pollution, and the combination leading toward more of the respiratory issues that we see with COVID, of the shortness of breath, pneumonia.
I think I saw that too. The pollution caused an upregulation in the ACE2 receptor.
Exactly.
Thus, there was more availability for the virus to get into cells.
And for the symptoms to intensify, because people are already having a compromise in their oxygen intake. And now they've been exposed to, you know, the pollutants and the, if they're in an urban environment or in a fire zone where the flame retardants have been sprayed, all of that is going to intensify.
That's crazy that you mentioned flame retardants, because they never mention that on the news. Like, they'll talk about air pollution, they'll talk about COVID, and they'll talk about all the other things going on, but not the flame retardants or those effects. The only times I've ever heard of flame retardants being readily available in the environment is on furniture.
Right. Well, think about what that red powder is that's coming out of airplanes. Mm-hmm. And I guess to not alarm the public, they probably downplay it, understandably. So the question is always, what can people do to improve their quality of air? In their home, for example, do they need a special air purifier? All the more reason they clean out the dust and repair anything that might show mold and do the proper testing for that, so that we could minimize their lung compromise and enhance their ability to breathe. It's really important. You know, some people do yoga and breath work, you know, as a way to mitigate some of the exposures. We offer here all kinds of supplements. You know, using some of the supplements is a broad range of antioxidants from NAC, curcumin, things people take in this practice that mitigates some of the exposures.
I've seen hyperbaric has good use as well. And that's done at Resilier.
Yes, hyperbaric. And then we also have infrared saunas, because whatever is in our body, we need to get out. And, you know, the lungs are a major organ of elimination. We breathe out toxins through our breathing cycle. But we also have this largest organ called the skin. And the skin, both, you know, what we put on our skin when we talk about cosmetics, as well as how our skin sweats and releases toxins that come to the surface from our internal toward the surface. It's really important we try to get them out. And that's the beauty of infrared saunas. There was a study many years ago after 9/11 in a medical journal that talked about firefighters that did infrared saunas and how they, when they analyzed the sweat, they found all of the chemicals that came down with the towers at 9/11, and how these firefighters were able to release and get rid of a lot of those toxins that they breathed in or fell on their bodies.
Did they say in the study how long they were holding on to those toxins? Because some people don't even realize that they have those toxins stored into their body.
That's true. And
not everyone's a firefighter.
That's true.
That's the air quality, how it gets
out. But I think it was a demonstration of after 9/11, how sweating and saunas helped release them. I don't know what the follow-up was. It was done within the year of 9/11. But I will say that studies show, and I'm sure many of the listeners know about the study that was done with the American Red Cross and the Environmental Working Group, looking at umbilical cord blood of newborns. And it showed at that time, which is more than a decade ago, over 238 chemicals that a baby was born into this world with, as an example of what they inherited from the mom, who may not have known that she had all those exposures, or from the dad through the sperm, if he was an occupational worker. But all of that gets passed down. And I just finished reading a study about heavy metals and mercury of children being exposed in utero from the mom who maybe ate too many tuna fish sandwiches or decided to have her mercury fillings taken care of before the baby was born because she felt she might not have time after, and how that baby was born with higher levels of mercury. And fast forward a lifetime, it becomes cumulative or manifests as we get older. Some of this stays in tissue, whether it's in the brain or in other parts of the body. And at some point, when we become overburdened with many other exposures, cumulatively, we start to see those results. Maybe that's even what we see if we look at some of the research on Alzheimer's. So we're always looking at how we look at a timeline of earliest exposures, and we don't always know.
So it could happen before you're born. So you have to know your whole life story if you are getting sick, apparently.
That's right. That's right.
But it does help with education if we're able to educate ourselves on what's making us sick. Our parents wouldn't have that problem, and maybe we wouldn't have that problem.
That's right. So there's an interesting belief about cleaning products. People believe that if it smells strong, it cleans better. That's an interesting thought to reflect
That's
on.
That's really funny. I've had that same problem getting an Airbnb during COVID time. I'm traveling in an RV right now, and I like to get mail on occasion, have a nice tub, but you'll go into these Airbnbs and they'll have heavy, heavy smells.
Yeah. And the question becomes, what does a cleaning product have to do with the fragrance? Why does that make it more potent? And yet there's a very strong cultural bias that if it doesn't smell like a cleaning product, it's not as effective. So that's number one, because whatever is in the air, we're breathing in, getting back to air quality. And so fragrances are notorious for a whole host of chemicals that have the ability to be toxic to the body, whether it be to the brain or circulating, and may have what's called properties that we call endocrine disruptors that can imitate hormones in the body and go into hormone receptor sites.
Is that the same thing as obesogenic? I saw that in one of your papers.
It's parallel.
Obesogens.
So obesogens are chemicals that actually can interfere with the way the body metabolizes fats. So this is a little aside, but you know, the person who does all the right things, they do exercise, they are eating well, they think they have a clean diet, and they're still not able to lose weight. There has to be a question by the coach or the practitioner, what are the chemicals in their environment that may be interfering with the ability for fat cells to metabolize and break down? And those are obesogens. And many of them overlap with the endocrine disruptors. They're very similar. And all of these get stored in fat tissue, so they confuse the cell signaling pathways.
So are they telling the cells to produce more fat, or are they telling it to keep its current fat?
To hold on to the fat. You know, it's normal to hold on to the fat. That's what animals do in winter, in nature. We eat and hold on to the fat to keep us warm. And even in humans, there's an instinct to eat warmer foods in winter and more, you know, fresh vegetables, salads in summer. It's just an intuitive, and a part of coaching is to help people reconnect to that intuitive part of themselves, of how what you eat affects how you feel. But the overlap of that is that the majority of chemicals that we get are in our food supply, the pesticides, the fertilizers. And those stay in the cells of the plant, and then we eat that plant, that vegetable, that fruit, and we're getting a high concentration. And those then get metabolized in a way that has an affinity towards certain fat cells in the body, or they act like hormonal markers, and they go to hormone receptor sites again.
So it could be any hormone, not just estrogenic.
Female and male, testicular, breast, not just estrogenic. A big one is actually thyroid. There's a whole other chemical component called goitrogen. Goiter is what can happen to the thyroid when the hormones.
The goitrogens, I've seen those in kale.
In very large amounts.
Very large amounts, okay.
But most of the chemicals in the environment that cause an influence on the thyroid, which also has to do with weight and energy and hormonal changes, are chemicals that are in a whole other classification called halogens. They're things like chlorine that people clean with or have in their swimming pools and you breathe in the vapors. Things like fluorine or fluoride, which is in our drinking water, and things like bromines or bromides, which have been used traditionally to make vegetables look perky in the market. So that we're exposed in many different ways to these thyroid mimicking hormones that are, again, chemicals.
Would iodine or iodide be in that same category, since it's a halogen?
And it isn't, because we need iodine in order for a thyroid to work. Whereas these imitate iodine, they're a similar family of chemicals, but they have more deleterious side effects.
Okay, that makes more sense. I've seen where there's a RDA for iodine, and I know some people with thyroid issues, especially if they're hyperthyroid, need to be on that.
That's right. But I would always look at and ask them about other chemicals. You know, when you turn the tap water on here in Florida during certain periods, whether your municipality warns you or not, you turn the water on and there are fumes of chlorine because they're trying to disinfect the water supply. So when we talk about our home environment, it's really important to know what is our water supply. And we don't always get the full spectrum of what's in the water from the municipalities. They may check for some mold spores. They may check for some, maybe even heavy metals. But I would always ask people, when was their home built? And if they have lead pipes, which was banned in 1978. So anyone that's living in an older home very possibly have lead pipes, and lead sloughs off over time, and there may be high amounts of lead in the drinking water. This is something that there's been some studies around the country, and the majority of municipal water systems do have high levels of lead. So then the question becomes, what do we need to do to filter out some of that lead? And there are many water filters and filtration systems that can do that.
What is a typical system that someone can use that they could just pick up? I've been using a Berkey filter and just adding electrolytes back into it. But what are some other things that people can use?
Berkey is good. There's a couple of commercial ones that you can use. I think Bed Bath & Beyond, Home Depot sells them. But I work with a company called Aquasana. Aquasana. And Aquasana has under-the-counter water filter systems. They have shower filters that go between the water input and the water coming through the system, you know, that eventually touches the person. And they also have outdoor full house systems for those that have a home that they could then just change the filter out. I think it's every 500 gallons. But it's aquasana.com. I think it's a very reliable system. Consumer Reports has supported it for many years.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's great. That's great to know. Now, in terms of cleaning products, because that's some of the household stuff that are hurting people. We're talking about how people think fragrance or something that's really strong in smell causes something to be clean, which you and I both know is inaccurate. What kind of cleaning products are we looking at, and what should we replace them with?
Easiest way to think of it is look at the ingredients. And if you see a long list of ingredients of long chemical names, you have to ask why. What are they? You know, even the hand sanitizers, the main ingredient is just old-fashioned alcohol. And that seems to be just as disinfecting as these products that have all these other chemicals that, again, we're putting on our hands, absorbing into our skin. I did a report years ago on a product called triclosan. And triclosan was what was in the hand sanitizers in hospitals. And when you looked at how many times a day, for example, a nurse had to use this triclosan product between patients, there were hundreds of times a day. And when you look at the research on triclosans, which the FDA finally banned after a long time of not, It showed that there were more birth defects, more miscarriages in women, higher rates of breast cancer. It's an endocrine disruptor, and I believe it's also neurotoxic.
That's crazy, and that's in a hospital.
In a hospital. Purell, which is what most hospitals use now, changed out, but only a couple of years ago. And when you look at what triclosan is still in, I have to say, it's as a disinfectant, it's still in toothpaste, and it's still in other personal care products.
Wow, so we're putting that right in our mouth.
Sometimes it's things like lauryl sulfates, and they're also in personal care and cleaning products, and many other chemicals that are used as disinfectants. And the question really is, do we really need all of that? When you look at the new soap detergents, for example, for washing machines, many of them say it's plant-based, and the fragrances are plant-based. So maybe it has orange or lemon fragrance, because people are so attached to fragrances, but it's not a chemical fragrance like in a deodorizer that you find in your Airbnb or hotel room.
So with these care products that have these fragrances in it, I want to tie this back to, we were talking earlier, someone who has mold issues or heavy metal issues. For me personally, I was never sure if I had mold issues, but I became more mold and chemically sensitive after using undiluted essential oils. And I've been trying to figure out, because I know of some haptans are potent immunostimulants. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the conclusion I've gotten to. But with cleaning products, I know those are very fragranced and cause my chemical sensitivity as well. And is that usually like a problem with the detoxification system, or is that something else that I'm not looking into?
It's probably a combination. It's probably the amount of exposures, again, cumulative over time. Maybe your body has a unique detoxification pathway. Maybe it's genetically triggered, and you may not be able to break down a certain chemical that other people may be able to break down. Because when you look at detoxification, there are many both nutrients and chemical pathways within innate to the body that need to be functional in order to neutralize and clear chemicals that come into the body. And when we look at people that have certain genetic, we call them singular nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, S-N-P-S, they might not have the ability, they might have a genetic marker that makes it more difficult. Now, the good news is that many nutrients are also involved both genetically in the body's ability to utilize them. And we can also supplement to tweak those pathways, if you will, so that the body could then detoxify more efficiently.
So that's the whole idea of epigenetics, is using something else to turn a gene on that wouldn't have worked otherwise?
Epigenetics exactly is part of it. That we have our genes, and then we have our exposures, and why, it goes back to a question you asked earlier, why some people don't show any symptoms and another person does. And we have to go back to what's their unique genetic predisposition. And if I could just say, here at Resilier, we do a lot of work around that, around genetic testing, around toxicity testing, mold testing, and we try to be, I call it environmental detectives, to figure out what the unique personalized approach is going to be to enhance those detoxification pathways, eliminating, really important, eliminating any of the triggers, any of those chemical exposures. And the way that I work as an environmental nurse educator and environmental nurse coach is to work with people to really look at all of their potential exposures, both present and past, because again, it may not be what they were exposed to last week. It may be the dentist who is retired now but worked with mercury fillings and plasticizers, which are very common in dental work, for many, many years and had exposures in the air from the mercury, perhaps touching their skin. And then here they are now, in older years and they have cognitive decline. And we need to look at what they had in their history and then what might be triggering their symptoms now. And then how do we mediate that?
So what are some questions that patients or people listening can ask themselves to try to be their own detectives?
Great question. I invite people to make a list of all of their favorite home cleaning products and make a list of all of your favorite, what we call personal care products, which is what you put on your skin, your hair, your face, that you use unknowingly many times a day. Or I should say you get exposures many times a day. And take a look at it, become consumer savvy, read the list, go online and Google. And if you want to, go to a website called Environmental Working Group. The acronym is EWG.org. They now have a new, they have little charts and cards that you can actually print out and take to the supermarket. You can go into their safecosmetics.org website arm, and you could look at the your favorite product, look at the ingredients that are in it. They even score it on a scale of 1 to 10 or 1 to 7, and you could see how strong that product is. And they give the product a rating if how dangerous it could be. And again, then offering you better choices. So EWG.org is great for looking at foods that are high in chemicals and pesticides and what they call the dirty dozen, which are the 12 foods highest, and then the clean 18, which are foods that don't need to be sprayed as heavily. Some foods actually have their own built-in chemicals that repel insects, so they don't need as many external pesticides. And I would encourage people to educate themselves, because there's something called the precautionary principle, which is better to take caution whether or not your governmental agencies say it's harmful. Because in a test tube, a little bit may not look harmful. But what about a little bit every day over decades?
It's impossible to study that, or it takes a really long time and a lot of effort.
Well, I think that people that have, a lot of times, people don't do this preventively. They wait until they have an autoimmune issue, which could be anything from MS to frequent colds and flus to other symptoms. Or they have something like, or they're starting to forget things. And suddenly there's a heightened interest because it didn't come out of nowhere. The rate of Alzheimer's and of cognitive decline is on the rise with younger and younger people, which we know. We also, on the rise is exposures to chemicals, both the ones that are external and the ones that are internal. The ones we breathe in through the air, the ones we take in through our food, the ones we take in through the water we drink. And so it really is up to us to take the precaution, because again, unfortunately, as consumers, we're not always protected the way we would hope to be. And then to do an experiment, you know, in the bigger world, we call it an elimination protocol, where eliminate food chemicals or foods that may be triggers and wait a couple of weeks and see if your symptoms improve or they lessen.
So in an ideal world, should people be eating less pesticides or going more towards organic or grass-fed meats?
In an ideal world, yes. Can everyone have access to organic? Not really. Can everyone afford organic? Not really, especially in these times. So we do the best we can. And the idea of that 12 dirty dozen of the most heavily chemical sprayed are the ones that people need to be extra careful about. An example would be berries. We love our raspberries and our blueberries. They're good for the brain. They're good for as antioxidants. But because we know how quickly they mold, because sugar comes to the surface, you know, you buy a box of blueberries and the bottom has mold before you even, you know, open it. sometimes.
Yeah.
That is worth now, you can at our local supermarket chain here in South Florida, Publix, Costco, Walmart. They're all selling organic blueberries. There's a big market there for people to get cleaner produce. So you can buy it and you can freeze it. Things are picked from the crop, immediately frozen. They don't have time to mold.
I also heard that when they're frozen, they have higher antioxidant levels.
Exactly. Because when food is exposed to air, a certain amount of antioxidant properties can diminish, and vitamins. So that frozen is actually a better choice for many people these days.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I read that when, for example, blueberries, when they're in the natural environment, they're producing a lot of antioxidants to defend themselves from the environment. And then once you put that cold stress on them, they produce a little bit more.
Great information. Yeah, so those are the simple things. You know, fruits that have skins, that's not as important, because even if it's been sprayed, that thick orange rind or avocado skin pretty much protects the fruit from the pesticides.
So they don't absorb any of that?
They don't absorb as much.
As much, okay.
Small amounts. And again, by doing the antioxidants, whether it's the blueberries and other fruits and vegetables, you're actually counterbalancing or counteracting the exposures that you might get from somewhere else, because all of those detoxification pathways are dependent on nutrients to function. That's the good news. But people that eat a poor quality diet, you know, canned food and chemical preserved foods, and they have other exposures, they're going to be higher at risk for all across-the-board diseases, whether it be cardiovascular, Alzheimer's,
yeah,
cancers. So this is, for whatever our genetic predisposition is, environmental concerns and environmental awareness is going to be the new medicine moving forward. We're still early in this, but more and more medical model research is beginning to show the impact of chemicals. So I went online this morning on PubMed, which is where research journals are published, and I was trying to get some information on heavy metals. And it's fascinating in the last year or two how much information is there on heavy metals, meaning mercury, arsenic, aluminum, cadmium, lead, and the brain. Because as we started off speaking about, heavy metals have a propensity toward brain tissue. And so we think that may be a very key component in our patients that we're seeing with cognitive decline.
Now, why is it that they are attracted to the brain?
That may be a bigger question than I can answer, but brain different cells have different affinities toward chemicals, just like I mentioned the endocrine disruptors, the bisphenol A, the plasticizers. Those have an affinity to endocrine tissue, or that take up other endocrine markers. And the brain seems to have an affinity for metals. And I'd have to get back to you on the exact mechanism of that.
Yeah, because I've seen in studies, like you're talking about, that metals, they essentially accumulate either in the brain or in your bones.
Exactly, both. And here's the thing. There are chemicals. There are neurological or chemicals that are interfered with for optimal cell signaling functioning when you have those heavy metals exposures.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the show and explaining this to us. Where can people find you and more information about if they want to find their own nurse coach?
I am here at Resilier. I'm part of the team, and I see patients both in conjunction with the medical doctor, the nurse practitioners, our acupuncturist, nutritionist, those people that it seems really need some coaching guidance, both around environmental, lifestyle, stress, sleep. All of these we know are markers of that can lead to what we'll call neuroinflammation. So all lifestyle factors are part of a coaching, holistic integrative coaching model, which is how what I work within. So they can reach me at susan.luck@resolierhealth.com. But I would encourage everyone on their own, whether they come here or not, to begin by making a list of all of the products that you use and researching them. Do your homework. Be an advocate for yourself. There are so many websites and information if you Google that. And then make a list of what you feel you can begin to change. List three products that you could change out for something healthier. One of the products that I always encourage is laundry detergent, because whatever you're using, whatever fragrance, whatever chemicals are on your pillowcase, you are breathing that in all night. And your breath is a mediator between your body and your brain, so that it's going to circulate in that way. And so have an idea of where you want to change. Change doesn't happen all at once. And part of a coaching model is change happens at the pace that the person is ready for. And we just want to support them in what we'll call their readiness for change. So cleaning products, fragrances is a great place to begin. On a personal care product, take an inventory of what you use daily. There's been a lot of talk about aluminum and commercial deodorants and, you know, the armpit sweats, so it also absorbs into the skin, and that aluminum can circulate into the body. And again, the armpit and the brain is not really that far away from one another.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have to think about that. And one thing I want to mention when we're talking about the home is think about what you're cooking with. People have used traditionally in modern times aluminum pots and pans. Aluminum, especially if there's any acidity, whether it's tomato sauce or lemon, will leach into the food that you're cooking with, that aluminum foil. Maybe try parchment paper. Maybe just try Pyrex dishes and try to change that out. Stainless steel is a much better choice, or ceramic or cast iron. Think about, do you use pesticides in your home? Do you really need to for those few ants? What's the downside of that for you, for the children, for the dog? Because all those pesticides fall onto the ground and then your cat or, you know, pet also licks their paws and can ingest it. So we're talking about, you know, all creatures. And if you do spray, make sure your windows are open. There are very harmless ant products. I bought one on Amazon that was plant-based that you can try. Some people just use lemon juice and white vinegar in a spray bottle around their door frames. And then identify other cleaning products and what you might want to use that's safer. There are so many brands out there. They're at, again, the supermarkets, at Walmart. We are in a time now, because there's increased awareness, that there's much more purchasing ability than ever before. So people should take advantage of that.
That's great. Yeah, there's so many alternatives now that we shouldn't be using these harsh chemicals anymore. Things that are messing us up, our families, our pets. That's great.
And can I just say that the companies want you, the consumer, to buy their products. So when Johnson & Johnson was exposed for having really toxic chemicals in their baby bubble bath products.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Remember that a couple of years ago? They changed them out because they wanted consumers to continue to buy their baby bubble bath. So they took out some of the fragrances and some of the sodium laureate and phthalates and other things that were in it, dyes and colorings. So all of that can be changed by consumer demand. So we do have the power if we use it.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you very much. And I hope that this has been helpful. And again, if anyone wants to get in touch with me, susan.luck@resolierhealth.com. Thank you all, and stay safe and be well.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys, for listening. And to find out more information, head over to ResolierHealth.com. And if you're looking to get healthy but don't know where to start, finding a nurse coach may be a great choice. So until next time, stay healthy. Na, 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 na.